May it please the court, Mr. Phillips will present argument for the relators.
Side a defense that the resisting party lacked the mental capacity to enter into a contract when one of the provisions of that contract provides for arbitration of disputes. In this case, Mr. Griffin claims that his ward, Helen Freeman Taylor, lacked the mental capacity to sign any of the new client account agreements with Morgan Stanley that she executed. This defense obviously goes to the entire agreement, not just the arbitration clause that was one of the clauses in that agreement. Under the Supreme Court's case in Prima Paint versus Flood and Conklin in 1967, the arbitration provision is deemed to have been separately agreed upon from the rest of the contract, so that if a party raises a defense to the contract as a whole, the parties are deemed to have made a separate agreement that provides for the arbitrator to resolve the underlying challenge to the whole contract. The language of Prima Paint was very broad, but the holding was limited to the particular defense raised in that case, which was fraud in the inducement. And thus, in the ensuing four decades, courts struggled with whether or not any and every defense to a contract should be decided by the arbitrator, or whether there were some exceptions under the FAA where the court should make an initial determination. Some courts held that the Prima Paint doctrine applied only to defenses based on the behavior of the parties, not defenses based on their status. Others opined and held that defenses that rendered the contract as a whole void, as opposed to merely voidable, should be decided by the court and not the arbitrator. The Supreme Court of Florida relied on that latter distinction, void and voidable, to hold that an arbitration clause in a usurious contract was not enforceable and could be so held by a court because under Florida law, a usurious contract was held to be void, ab initio, and not merely voidable. The Supreme Court of the United States took that appeal in Buckeye Check Casting versus Cardenia. The court expressly adopted Prima Paint and very broadly and extended it and held that Florida's distinction between voided and voidable contracts was not valid under Section 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act. Since that statute referred to revocation of a contract, said the court, there can be no doubt that a contract must include contracts that later prove to be void. But still, Buckeye did not hold that a defense raised to every type of contract had to go to an arbitrator. In footnote 1, which is provided for you in big type in tab 2 of our joint bench book, the court said, the issue of the contract's validity is different from the issue whether any agreement between the alleged obligor and obligee was ever concluded. Our opinion today addresses only the former and does not speak to cases which hold that it is for courts to decide whether the alleged obligor ever signed the contract, whether the signor lacked authority to commit the alleged principal, and whether the signor lacked the mental capacity to assent. That final line is really the basis of why we're here today, because there has been no state Supreme Court and nor Court of Appeals opinion on what that language means since Buckeye. And there have been two federal district court opinions and one state trial court opinion that I will later explain are distinguishable.
State trial court or court of appeals?
It was state trial court in Tennessee, I believe, court of chancery. Well, maybe it was went to court of appeals, yes. Not a state Supreme Court. Thus, as one case has recognized, Florida appellate court, Buckeye acknowledged that a third potential type of challenge exists, but the court declined to state who, the court or the arbitrator, should decide this issue. If the court interprets the Federal Arbitration Act to say that an arbitrator should decide all such disputes, then obviously the probate judge in this case abused his discretion and mandamus should be granted. But if the court decides that the type of defenses referenced in Buckeye footnote 1 should be decided by the court, the probate court still abused his discretion under the facts of this case and the law of the state. The only guidance that this court has in interpreting the Federal Arbitration Act is the language of footnote 1, where Justice Scalia, speaking for 8 members of the court, said the issue is, quote, whether any agreement between the alleged obligor and obligee has ever been concluded. Under Texas law, we know that these new client account agreements between Morgan Stanley and Mrs. Taylor were concluded. It is clear under the FAA that each state's law governs on the issue of whether a contract has ever been formed. And under Texas law, a defense of lack of mental capacity does not prevent a party from making a contract. That contract, this court has held in a writ refused case, is voidable but not void. That means that Mrs. Taylor or her successors at their options could enforce a contract that they made with Morgan Stanley. And it also means that Morgan Stanley could seek to enforce that contract and could enforce it unless Mrs. Taylor or her successors raised lack of mental capacity as a defense.
So I'm looking at what I think is Section 4 of the FAA, which, as I read it, says the federal district court may order arbitration, quote, upon being satisfied that the making of the agreement for arbitration or the failure to comply therewith is not an issue. Okay, the making of the agreement. But you would say that mental capacity doesn't go to the making of the agreement.
That's right. This is essentially sort of circular. First, it's not clear to me, and I spent about 30 minutes this morning trying to figure it out, whether or not Section 4 applies to state courts or not. It's purely procedural and talks about a federal district court. And the best place to look is page 445 of the Buckeye opinion, which seems to impart some of the Section 4 language into Section 2, but it doesn't actually say that. At any rate, all that actually clearly applies to a state court, I think, is Section 2. But let's assume this does apply, or has been imported or should be borrowed. The making of the arbitration agreement refers both to a separate arbitration agreement, and a number of the cases that Mr. Griffin cites are cases where there's a separate standalone arbitration agreement. And there, all these defenses, of course, can and have to be decided by the court before a case is referred to arbitration. Secondly, to the extent that it's talking about the making of an agreement and the defense to that goes to the contract as a whole, you're right into prima facie. In fact, prima facie was a Section 4 case. So we've got the concept of severability that is read into, superimposed on, part of this language in Section 4 if it applies to a case that starts out in state court.
So what issues do you think are judicial issues?
Well, it seems to me if footnote 1, which says we're not going to decide this, if it's later decided that that means there is a category, it seems to me that the proper line the Supreme Court used when they talked about concluding a contract is between the existence of a contract and the content of that contract.
Is that the same as the voidable distinction?
Well, in some instances is, and some it isn't. I'm glad I'll finish this thought, and then I'll take you to language that I think explains this. It's not quite the same because in the Florida case of Cardenia, the parties had no doubt made this usurious contract. It existed. You couldn't take it away. It just wasn't enforceable. Since it was usurious, apparently neither side could enforce it under Florida law, and that may vary from state to state. So I think a forgery case, if a defense is we've never signed, that's not our signature. Under Texas law, Board of Trustees of Tarrant County Junior College versus National Indemnity Company, 484 Southwest 2nd, 399, that's a void contract. Neither side can enforce it. I can't say, well, that's not my signature, but I sure would like that loan at 3%, so give it to me. And the bank can't obviously hold you to pay off a loan you never signed. So I would think that's an easy one. Forgery's pretty easy. Usury falls on the other side. I think agency is tougher, but if the law of the state is that you have to prove agency, and if the agent didn't have authority, actual or apparent to make an agreement, then you're not bound by it, then that would fall on the side of a contract that was never concluded.
What about a contract of a minor, a five-year-old? You know, I mean, obviously he or she shouldn't or can't be bound by that. Is that a voidable thing? Is it more
minors
like forgery?
Minors are pretty close to mental incapacity in the law, but I don't think they're... You can read Texture, which collects all the cases, and end up not being sure what you've read. And it depends on the type of contract it is, but most of the time a minor can subsequently ratify a contract and can enforce that contract. It's at the minor's option to get out of that contract. But the nuances of it seem to me to be a little bit different than mental capacity. Returning to Justice Heck's question on void and voidable.
Well, what about illegality?
Illegality, it seems to me, has been foreclosed by Buckeye. If you made the deal, the arbitrator has to decide.
A gambling contract goes to the arbitrator.
A gambling contract goes to the arbitrator. You made that deal. Maybe neither side can enforce it. Only the IRS can enforce it.
Need to tell the gamblers about that. Normally unenforceable, but who knows what an arbitrator will do, right?
Well... There is an underlying prejudice, I think, that permeates a lot of the literature against arbitration, and which is why I included tab 9 to our joint exhibit book. The arbitrations that arise from a dispute over a brokerage contract are not decided in some fly-by-night matter, some secret arbitration. They are decided pursuant to the rules of FINRA, which is the successor to the NASD. And every arbitration award is posted online virtually instantly after it's handed down. The front page there is the FINRA homepage. Arbitration and mediation is the bottom thing. You punch that. The next screen has most viewed, and the first one is arbitration awards online. You punch that, and you fill in the name of the case or the document number or the dates it was decided. So I did 919 through 922 and pulled up a number of cases. I picked the third one, which is the Nielsen Award, and that's a complaint by the Nielsens against Schwab, and they asked for $365,000 and got $304,000. The claimants win 40% to 50% of their claims in these arbitrations. It's a transparent process. There's three different lists.
Are you suggesting we might decide the case differently if there were not this kind of formality?
No. I just think it's good background to know that there are arbitrations that have come under a lot of attack, and those that have generally not been included within the scope of areas that, for instance, the legislature is looking at restricting. I want to ask you to turn your attention to tab 5, which is a case called Barilisle versus Time Warner Cable that was written by Judge Kimball Wood in the Southern District of New York, and turn to footnote 14, which is on page 8 of this printout and on star 6 of the opinion. And Judge Wood is talking about some of the cases which set up some of these distinctions, principally cases involving the power of an agent. And what effect they were affected by the voidable language in Buckeye. And she says, the last sentence of that footnote 14 in the right-hand column, these cases appear to use a different definition of void than the Buckeye check cashing court, which found that a claim that a contract containing an arbitration is, quote, void for illegality, unquote, because it violated state laws, must be resolved by an arbitrator, not a court. Because Spear Drake and its progeny actually used the term void in the sense of non-existent, those cases appear to be consistent with Buckeye cashing, despite the potential confusion caused by the differing use of the same terms. So I think if the court focuses on the word concluded, it's easy to see that void and voidable still has a place in terms of if there's been a concluded contract that one party has the authority to get out of versus the type of void contract that simply doesn't ever exist.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the real party in interest.
May it please the court. Mr. Frazier will present argument for the real party in interest.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Because Griffin's mental capacity challenge goes to the formation of the contract under Section 4 and cannot logically be addressed solely to the arbitration clause in the contract, the court did not clearly abuse its discretion in holding that a capacity challenge is for the court and not for the arbitrator. Arbitration, in essence, the scope, the whole premise of arbitration is agreement. Therefore, an assent-based challenge to the underlying contract is an exception to the bright line test of prima facie. So there are two grounds the court can rule in favor or hold that the trial court or the probate court did not abuse its discretion. First is what has been argued already, and that is whether or not the challenge goes to the formation or the making, as Justice Willett pointed out in Section 4, of the contract. Now, I'll go right to the point of the void versus voidable issue. Both the Supreme Court in Buckeye and even the Fifth Circuit in other decisions have made it clear that the void and voidable distinction is immaterial. Courts that have applied the prima facie a template, if you will, have applied it in contracts that the state law holds or held was void as well as voidable. The courts that apply the Spar versus Secco, the 10th Circuit case that we rely upon, paradigm, also apply that analysis on both void and voidable contracts. So that is truly immaterial. What is material is whether the defense, as Justice Scalia pointed out in footnote 1 in Buckeye, challenges the signatory power. If you look at tab 2 and you'll see the list of cases, the three types, those have been grouped into signatory power challenges. Was there a mental assent? Did the signatory have authority? Did the signatory have capacity? That's what we have to look at. If there was no assent, no meeting of the minds, no mutual assent, then that focuses, and that by definition addresses the making of a contract, and under Section 4, it goes to the trial court, not to the arbitrator. That's the first premise that this court can uphold or deny mandamus on the trial, the probate court's decision. Secondly, if the court wants to apply or look at the prima facie and says and believes that there is a contract for purposes of this argument, then the Spar versus Secco analysis is the second ground. In that case, and that is at tab 4 of the handout, the 10th Circuit grappled with a defense that cannot be parsed between the contract in its entirety and an arbitration provision contained therein. Now, conduct-based defenses such as illegality, fraud in the inducement, duress, unconscionability that this court has actually addressed can be parsed between the two. You can have fraud in inducing arbitration as opposed to allowing a party to have their grievances addressed in the courts. But if you are incapacitated, mentally incapable of understanding what you're doing, you cannot have capacity as to one provision, yet have capacity as to the entire contract.
Could Taylor insist on arbitration?
Could Taylor insist on arbitration? I don't think there was a meeting of the mind, so that goes to whether or not she could even enforce the agreement.
They did trading for years, right?
The agreements were entered into from 99 and some in 2003, though, so there was some trading.
Of hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yes. In fact, the premise of our claim is that they stole sold $3.5 million worth of Exxon stock and put it into speculative agreements or speculative investments. So there was activity under that. But
so how can you, after you've made use of the brokerage for years to move lots and lots of money around, then come back and say, well, but I had no capacity. So none of it's been valid. Aren't you too far down the road to do that?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think so because, again, the court's looking at contracts, whether they are voidable later to be determined void or void ab initio, have applied the SPAR versus SECO and the defense of mental capacity and said that you cannot go to arbitration.
But if
so it does, whether or not there was trading or not, whether or not there was a voidable contract, the courts have gone through your initial formation.
What if you, you know, borrowed $1 million and then after you got the money you said, I had no mental capacity, so I don't have to pay it back. We wouldn't give that person the time of day. If you take the benefit of the contract, you're stopped to claim, well, but I don't have to live up to the obligations.
I think under some circumstances, but the courts in Texas have been less than clear about whether contracts with incompetence are void ab initio, or whether they're voidable. The key is this challenge going to the making, the formation? Or if there is a contract, say there is a contract, then it doesn't fit the prima facie template. Excuse me.
But it's one thing to let the potentially incompetent promisor out of the contract on that basis. But it's another thing to force the party out because the other party doesn't want to perform and says, no, you were incompetent. That seems rather perverse. I don't have to sell you the land because you were crazy when you offer to buy it.
Well, I know there are some circumstances, Your Honor, where there may be in some inconsistency, but under the facts of this case, there is evidence that she lacked the mental capacity, which is the whole reason why there is a lawsuit, because $5 billion of her estate have been whittled away.
But in my example, the seller can't defend for the breach of contract case on the basis that the buyer was incompetent at the time of the contract, can he?
I don't think so.
Can he? Well, it seems a sort of perverse result that one side could enforce this arbitration agreement, but not the other side. Ms. Taylor could if she wanted to, but Morgan Stanley can't.
I think we're looking at balancing the equities and balancing the public policy behind protecting someone incompetent like Ms. Taylor, who has had her estate whittled away, and the rights of the parties to continue on and enforce the agreement. And we believe that this challenge goes to protecting someone like Ms. Taylor, who has been harmed. And going into the formation, that's what it attacks, and the case law that has come down since SPAR versus SECO and since Buckeye have all held that capacity challenges are to be decided by the court.
But you look at that in terms of protection, and I see that argument going to the merits. The cases have said arbitration isn't a detriment necessarily. It's just a forum. It's a different way to resolve the litigation. So I'm not sure I understand that argument. I am curious about the void versus voidable. The opposition says, no, we're pretty clear in Texas that this is a voidable type issue, not void. And
there are two cases in footnote 3 of our brief that have held that contracts, the Carger and O'Brien cases, that contracts with incompetence are void ab initio. And so we have some disparity. But I want to go back and reemphasize that the United States Supreme Court has held, in terms of the FAA, the void versus voidable issue is immaterial. In every court that has addressed mental capacity since SPAR v. SECO and since Buckeye has held that challenge goes to the court. Now, I know Primerica is out there and hasn't been addressed, but that's the Fifth Circuit case that Judge Jones wrote. That was the first case that we have found that has that addressed the mental capacity, the assent-based challenge to an FAA arbitration agreement. They had nothing to work with. And so they took the PrimaPaint template, placed it on the defense at hand, mental capacity, and saw that it was made to the entire contract, not just the arbitration clause, and therefore held that PrimaPaint applies. It wasn't to the clause by itself. Therefore, it goes to arbitration. But 6 years have passed since Primerica.
It seems to me the panel was aware of the issue because Judge Dennis wrote in his concurrence that there are all these other issues and we're not getting into those, and he seemed to be worried that maybe the majority was. So at least they seem to have had in mind this problem.
They may have. They were the first to apply that. And since Primerica, which was in August 2002, 10 months later, we have Spar versus SECO, which, as the court is well aware in the briefs we laid that out, contains facts virtually identical to this case. And that's where the court said we cannot logically apply PrimaPaint to a status-based defense such as incapacity. So we had
that's
Spar.
But that's not what Buckeye says.
Buckeye. Then we have Buckeye.
It just says we're not telling you.
Well, Buckeye set out in footnote that there is a distinction. That there is a distinction.
But they didn't say whether that distinction made any difference.
Well, the footnote 2, Justice Brister, says that it is for the courts to decide whether or not a signor has the mental capacity to assent, citing Spar versus SECO,
all they're saying is does not speak to the issue decided by those cases. The cases hold that.
Yes.
But we're all waiting with bated breath to see what the Supreme Court thinks.
Yes. But I believe that this footnote sets out a distinction between signatory-based challenges that we're making and challenges that go to the validity of an agreement. And since Buckeye, we have had several other courts across the country that have addressed that. Interesting, in the Spar versus SECO case, Judge Tom Reveley was sitting by assignment. And so now that 6 years have passed, we have Spar, we have Buckeye, we have three other courts after Buckeye holding in our favor, asserting our position. We have many commentators. I have not seen any commentators that have agreed with the Primerica challenge or the Primerica holding, but have challenged that holding. Have supported the SECO. And then we have Citigroup versus Brown, which is tab 6 in the handout. Now, I put that in there, and I'll just be up front. That court did not flatly address or decide this issue about mental incapacity, but the court did say, without deciding, we assume that the trial court had authority to address the mental capacity defense and goes through the evidence that the trial court considered, and the Court of Appeals addresses that. That was the 14th Court of Appeals, and it's, again, in tab 6 just this past August. So now that we're removed 6 years from Primerica, we may have a different decision if an en banc court of the Fifth Circuit reconvenes or convenes on this issue. But there are two grounds.
Following through on that, the issue of whether client was had mental capacity at the time she signed would be a jury issue in court.
Yes.
So how's this going to work? Trial judge makes you have the motion to compel. The trial judge says, well, I think there's a fact issue. So then we do a jury trial, and I suppose we do discovery and have experts and all the things us folks in courts do. And then if the jury decides she did have capacity, then it doesn't matter that we've done all this. It all goes to arbitration. That's not going to work very well, is it?
Well, but I think the cases contemplate, Your Honor, a procedure where the court makes a determination about the capacity defense.
Right, but in Texas, that determination is a jury determination.
It can be, yes. But we have uncontroverted evidence here at this hearing. And if the court decides that the probate court should decide the issue and sends it to the probate court to determine finally, if the court determines it hadn't made that finding, which I think the evidence can support that, but then the court makes that finding, and then it goes to arbitration or continues.
My point is, it is exactly the same as the issue in the case, the merits issue in the case. That's got to be a jury determination. It only gets to the jury if the judge decides she didn't have capacity, and if the jury decides otherwise, then all of that was a mistake, and what do we do then?
Well, you stay in the trial court, because same thing can happen in the arbitration realm.
Didn't we just violate the supremacy clause if we did that? I mean, this is a federal statute.
Yes.
And if a jury finds she agreed to go to arbitration, we can't say, well, but that's our procedures trump that federal law.
The federal cases say that the trial court, the FAA says that the trial court decides this issue. And so I think they contemplate that if it's a challenge to the making of the agreement, that stays in the trial court, and arbitrators can't decide something that may not have ever existed. And I think that's part of the policy behind the FAA. I think that balances the leaning toward arbitration versus the realities.
Well, no, I mean, I see a distinction between somebody who just, I never signed that agreement at all. But there's no question your lady signed this agreement.
She signed some of them, yes.
Do you agree with the relator that any one of the signed agreements would cover all claims made in the underlying case?
I don't necessarily agree with that. We only have two of the agreements in the record, and having read those, there are reasons why subsequent agreements were signed. So I don't know if some of the transactions were unique to a certain agreement and some unique to an agreement that was purportedly signed by a trustee. So, Your Honor, from this record, I don't know the answer to that, if it would cover everything.
Is there any question that the federal statute applies?
No, Your Honor. It involves securities, and we believe the FAA does apply.
But Taylor's competency has not been decided so far. Is that true?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor, and we have raised that. In fact, they have attacked that in their briefs. We in response to the motion to compel, we said that she is not incompetent, and we presented evidence of her incompetency. And Morgan Stanley said, well, it's irrelevant. If the court wants to consider it, then we want an evidentiary hearing. Well, the court considered it. It was before the court. It was argued extensively. And they never asked for an evidentiary hearing. Now, we have argued that that evidence is sufficient to support a finding of incompetency. Now, if this court decides that that issue
was one made.
Well, if it was made, it was implied. He just simply denied the motion. So there's a good argument that it was not made or it was impliedly made. But the record supports incapacity, we believe, and there was no challenge to that evidence or no controverting evidence presented at the hearing. And under TIPS and in Re Jebia, it's the duty upon Morgan Stanley in this circumstance to request an evidentiary hearing if there's a disputed fact issue as to whether or not there was an arbitration agreement.
What do you make of opposing counsel's point that it's really unclear whether Section 4 is anything more than procedural and whether it even applies to state courts to begin with?
I don't think it applies uniquely to the district courts. I believe it goes to if the making is an issue, then we can't send it to arbitration, whether it's in a federal court or whether it's in state court, because we don't know if there's an arbitration agreement in the first place. We certainly can't go to arbitration. So I think, Your Honor, it applies in both. I don't think it's merely federal procedure. I think it says if the making is at issue, and under Housem, unless there's clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties intended, agreed, assented that there be arbitration, unless that's the case, it doesn't go to arbitration.
Would you say then that a minor can't sign a contract for arbitration in which an arbitration clause exists?
I think just like an incompetent, they may be able to sign it, but it's not enforceable.
So you can't compel arbitration in that context?
I believe you can't. I think, again, the cases are mixed about whether or not it's void ab initio.
The issue will come up, I'm sure. There are all these, employers, grocery companies, and fast food restaurants, et cetera, that have arbitration agreements in
a work injury benefit plan, and you would say that all of those are void, or at least the employer cannot compel arbitration in those contexts for the minors.
Yes, Spar versus Seco, and there's a Circuit City case following Spar where that was the very issue, Your Honor. The Circuit City case, it was a minor who was employed by Circuit City. There was an arbitration agreement, and the court held that that could not be enforced. It was a capacity, mental, assent-based challenge, and it went and stayed in the trial court. That case applies here, as does Spar versus Seco. We ask that the court rule that the probate court did not abuse its discretion.
And there's no question that the competency issue goes to the entire agreement, not just the arbitration clause.
Yes, Your Honor, because I think it can only go to the entire agreement, that type of challenge, which is, again, the basis for the ruling in Spar versus Seco in the following cases.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Frazier.
Thank you.
First, I think state law is pretty clear. Neal versus Pure Oil was a refused opinion from 1937 that says contracts with mental incompetence in Texas are voidable, not void. There are some cases that are cited in Griffin's footnote 3. Most of them involve minors, as does Cargan versus Sorrentino that he just mentioned, which is why I said earlier maybe there is some difference between minors. That was a case where the minor bought a car and then tried to give it back. And they said in that case where there's been an attempt at rescission, it's void ab initio. Second, I dispute the notion that there's this whole mound of precedent on one side and nothing on the other side. Spar versus Seco, as you heard, turned on a distinction that when a defense cannot be parsed between the arbitration clause itself and the whole contract, then prima facie doesn't apply. The Supreme Court said nothing about that in Buckeye. The focus now has got to be on whether an agreement was concluded, because that's the language in Buckeye footnote 1. And I'm very glad Justice Heck brought up Judge Dennis's concurrence in Primerica versus Brown, the Fifth Circuit case. If you don't buy Judge Jones's view that all these things should go to arbitration because these distinctions start getting pretty nebulous around the edges, if you don't buy that, then Judge Dennis relied on the fact that in Mississippi law, a contract with a mental incompetent was voidable and not void. And so he says there has been this split that's come around the circuits, but we don't need to deal with it here because this is a case where a contract was initially made. Actually, Judge Dennis was quite prescient. He saw what was coming in the future, I think. Now, the three cases that have come since the Buckeye case that are more or less on this issue are all quite distinguishable. One is Foss versus Circuit City Stores, which is from the Federal District Court of Maine. That was an infancy claim, not mental incompetent. Under Maine law, unless there was a written ratification later, the contract never came into existence, so it was voidable, not void. And secondly, it appears there was a separate dispute resolution agreement. It's not absolutely clear from the opinion, but that's the way it reads to me. And, of course, there you don't have Primerica. If it's merely an arbitration agreement standing alone, the federal court or the state court does have to decide all this. Reimer versus 21st Century Mortgage, which is the Tennessee Court of Appeals, has two differences. One, Tennessee is one of that small minority of states where a contract with an incompetent person is void, and there's no doubt about it, and the Reimer court cited that. Secondly, definitely there was a separate arbitration agreement. So it really didn't matter if it was void or voidable. And Washburn was also a separate arbitration agreement, the federal district court in Georgia.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and that concludes all oral arguments for this morning. The clerk will now adjourn the court.
All rise.
Oh, yay.
Oh, yay. Oh, yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.